welcome to the Texas Crime Cast by the Dallas Morning News. I'm Jen Emily. Today we'll be talking about the capture of murder suspect Brenda Delgado, the latest in the saga of affluenza teen Ethan Couch, the murder of Stacy Fawcett and her son at the hands of another son, and a domestic violence survivor awarded $40 million by a Dallas County grand jury. My co-hosts today are Nahid Rajwani.
Hello.
And Julie Fancher.
Hello.
Editorial writer Mike Hashimoto will end the show in our usual way with his latest Hashing It Out segment with his commentary on Ethan Couch. Julie, you've been writing about the murder of Stacy Fawcett and her teenage son. Can you tell us what happened?
So Plano police say that McCann Utu Jr., who's the 19-year-old son of Stacy Fawcett, fatally stabbed his mother and his 17-year-old brother, Josiah, overnight on Friday at their Plano home. And there's not a lot of details about exactly what happened, but police said that they got a call around 12:30 in the morning from McCann saying that he had killed both his mother and his brother and that he had committed murder. And when police got there, McCann had had stabbed himself several times, was taken to a hospital where he later died. And so that's all we really know right now about the specifics of that.
Is there really any indication yet of why he would do this or what may have been going on?
Well, we talked to friends and family who said that they believe what contributed to this is McCann had suffered two concussions in the last 2 years. One playing basketball at Plano West, where he was where he graduated from in 2015, and the second concussion happened during an altercation with another student. And both family and friends said that those concussions just completely changed him. He was never the same. And his behavior, it just altered his behavior, altered who he was. And they just believe that was a contributing factor to what led to this. At a memorial service, his father talked a little bit about the head injuries that he believed played a role. And so we can hear a little bit from his dad.
For every parent who has a child in any sports, I ask you to think about how can we make changes? How can we protect our precious children who love sports? But suffer these terrible head injuries because my son paid the ultimate sacrifice.
And he was talking at the funeral, and the family decided to have one funeral for both mom and her sons, despite what had happened. Did they talk at all about why they did this, or do you have any insight into that?
Yeah, that was something that I think a lot of our readers had kind of questioned. Why would they have one service, especially given what the one son was accused of? But they, you know, Stacy Fawcett's brother basically said they were a family and they loved each other. And there was no question that this is what they would have wanted, is one service. But that McCann had a mental illness, and, you know, this wasn't something that he did because he hated his family. He just was suffering. And Stacy Fawcett's brother, Scott Fawcett, kind of addressed that right at the beginning of his eulogy. We can hear a little bit from him.
There's been kind of this obvious underlying question constantly of how many funerals are we going to have here? And I've really been very proud of our family, because while that is a legitimate question, it truly never even occurred to us to be like, well, should we have one, two, or three funerals? I mean, we're having one funeral. There's, obviously, these three would only want to get, would want to go to heaven together. And the thought of memorializing them separately truly makes even less sense to us than the tragedy of why we're all here. I mean, these people were together. They were family.
It was actually pretty an amazing memorial service. There was about 2,000 people there. Stacy Fawcett was a popular WFAA contributor who had a food segment every Saturday. I mean, There was a lot of people there to support this family, despite, you know, what the son was, McCann was accused of.
Were there any signs before this that something was wrong? Was there violence? What was going on, or what do we know?
So some of McCann's friends had said that they noticed something was different after the second concussion, that McCann isolated himself. He withdrew. He really just kind of stopped being himself. He didn't go to college. He lived at home, but no one really talked to him. And they actually later noticed some tweets that he had sent out, like the days before this happened, where he said he was going to probably be the next to die. They were just very cryptic tweets that they actually said they had wished they had paid more attention to. But Stacey Fawcett's brother, Scott, had also mentioned that they did see signs. They knew something was wrong. They did what they could to try to get some help, but there was really not much that they could do. You know, they had taken him to doctors. They had taken him to a therapist. But you can't really call the police because you're fighting with your teenage son. If that was the case, probably every family would have to call the police, you know, once a week. But they, you know, he kind of said that he had wished that, you know, there had been some violence, so they could have called the police before this happened. But it basically went from no violence to too much violence. And now they can't do anything.
So, Naheed, Ethan Couch had his first day in adult court this week, and you were there and saw what happened. Listeners may know him as the affluenza teen, but they may not really recall the background. Can you catch us up on what he did to get in trouble and how his case moved from juvenile court to adult court?
Sure. So Ethan Couch was partying one night in June 2013 at his father's house in Burleson. That night he had, authorities say he drank a lot. He crashed into a woman whose car had broken down in the middle of the road, on the side of the road, and three people who had stopped to help her. All four of them died. Multiple others were injured. And this case really took off in part because at Couch's trial, there'd been a psychologist who'd said something along the lines of him suffering from affluenza, which is basically a condition that the psychologist described where his parents were so wealthy that he didn't really understand or comprehend the consequences of his action. So that created a lot of outrage because people were saying, how can this rich, wealthy, people believe that maybe this was his way of getting out of something that he'd done.
And so now Ethan Couch is pretty much nationally known as someone who's notorious. People mm-hmm. know, they may not know all the specifics, the names of the victims, but they know what he did. And if you mention affluenza, they're going to think of Texas and they're going to think of Ethan Couch.
That's correct. It was after he was sentenced. I mean, part of his sentence was the 10 years in probation and also time in rehab. But he really just came back into the headlines. He kind of crept back after that. He was accused of violating his probation, which a lot of people thought was already an easy sentence for him, and accused of fleeing to Mexico while authorities investigated that allegation.
And he was accused of violating his probation by basically being around drinking.
Yes. So there was a video that was posted in Twitter in December, and they said it seemed to show these teenagers at a party where drinks were readily available, it seems. And that was under investigation. Authorities hadn't really concluded when Ethan left the country that he was the one that was in that video.
And the funny thing, or not really the funny thing, the odd thing about this is that if he hadn't fled to Mexico, he would have gotten in trouble, but he probably wouldn't have gone to jail. He was in juvenile court. There's a good chance he would have been severely reprimanded, maybe given another chance, maybe his last chance. But instead, he and his mom flee to Mexico, and now he's in jail, and his mother is looking at a possible indictment.
Yeah, so right now, the way the case is playing out is, yes, he was 18. He was 18 when he allegedly fled the country, but his case was actually still part of the juvenile system. So while he was an adult, legally, his case was still juvenile. So he couldn't necessarily have been reprimanded too severely for fleeing to Mexico or even appearing in that video. But now, as it stands, the adult judge in the case that heard it yesterday, has decided that Couch will spend 180 days in county jail for each of the four manslaughter or intoxication manslaughter charges that he was convicted of in 2014. So that amounts to about 2 years in jail. We don't know if the judge is actually going to be finalizing that ruling yet. He's given the attorneys in the case 2 weeks to change his mind or, you know, prove him wrong. So I guess we'll have to see in 2 weeks what happens.
And is this jail time, is it a condition of his probation or is it a sentence?
It is actually, it's not a sentence. It's a condition of his probation. When the case transfers over to adult court, an adult judge has the, you know, can look at your probation and say, these are going to be the number of rules that we're going to have. So this is what Judge Wayne Salvant at the Tarrant County Courthouse had to say at his hearing on Wednesday.
You are to commit no offenses against the laws of this state or any other state or of the United States. You are to avoid injurious or vicious habits, abstain from illegal use of controlled substances, marijuana, cannabinoids, or consumption of alcohol beverages. You are to avoid persons and places of disruptible or harmful character. When you are released, you are to report to Community Supervision and Corrections Department of Tarrant County, Texas, immediately following a hearing that we might have and monthly thereafter, or as scheduled by the court or the community supervision officer.
So this is actually, these conditions would go in effect after Couch left the jail.
And I just want to add, there is no question that judge is from the South. I wouldn't even say Texas, just the South. I mean, he could almost, like, I can't remember what he looks like, but he sounds like a movie judge in the South.
He does allow cameras in his courtroom and reporters with laptops, so.
There you go. So how did Couch appear in court?
He appeared a lot older than when we saw him, the photos of him at his trial. I mean, he has darker hair. He has longer hair. He has a very shaggy hair, you know, hairstyle, which, I mean, he's been in custody for a few months now. So it's understandable. But he has a beard, very quiet. He didn't seem to have many expressions in the courtroom. Of course, we were sitting behind him, so we couldn't see much. But he didn't say much. He was asked yes or no questions, which is pretty typical in their defendants and, you know, when individuals are in court. But asked yes or no questions, many of those answers were, you know, followed a little and a glance at his attorney.
When I saw, like, the back of him, was that it looked like either he was balding now or maybe was it just the light shining on his head? Or, I mean, he's only 19.
Yeah, I don't know. But, I mean, you can definitely see, I mean, he's aged a lot. I mean, you see photos of him when he's 16, just very, you know, young looking. And now you see him, he really does look like an adult.
Nahid, what was that courtroom like? Because, I mean, this case has made a lot of people angry, and I can only imagine going to that courtroom. Is it mostly people who just want to watch him be sentenced or be held responsible, or what's that like?
Yeah, so when we're sitting in the courtroom, first of all, a lot of reporters, not just locally, but you've got the New York Times, someone was representing the Daily Mail from, you know, the tabloid from the UK. So there's a lot of news reporters from across the country that are there. But you know, on the left, as some of us in the courtroom called it Team Couch, because it was Fred Couch, Ethan Couch's half-brother. Ethan Couch's mother's attorney now, Tanya Couch, his mother was not in the courtroom. She's on house arrest in Tarrant County, so she was not there, but her attorney was there, so she was represented there. Then on the left, you have you know, a few young people who were, I'm assuming they were just there to watch the proceedings. But then you had people like the brother of Sergio Molina, who was paralyzed after the crash. So you kind of, it was interesting seeing all the dynamics play out. This was a hearing that a lot of us had really anticipated. It was very well anticipated in recent weeks. So I guess it was kind of a climax, as I guess you could say.
So is it too soon to determine if Couch has learned anything from all this? I mean, he's only been in jail a couple of months. I mean, and he didn't really say that much, just one word answers to the judge, or maybe two answers if it was no, sir, and not just no.
We don't know, I guess, what he's thinking, but Sheriff D. Anderson, the Tarrant County Sheriff, had a few ideas. This time the sheriff and his office have been very outspoken about this case, because many of them ended up investigating it and seeing the wreckage that was out there that night in June 2013. But the sheriff actually seemed a little bit more sympathetic toward Ethan Couch. He said at a news conference after the hearing that, you know, he's cooperated with the jail staff. They've had zero issues with him. And then he went on to say, you know, quote, "I do think that it's having an impact on him. I do believe that he is not the same person when he came in." And we asked him to elaborate on that a little bit. And the sheriff said, you know, Couch spends 23 hours a day alone in his jail cell. He's in isolation, partly because they say it's for his safety, but he only gets an hour of free time. And as you can imagine, someone who's spending all that time alone with not much human interaction, it could probably be something that just ends up being, as the sheriff described it, as like a wake-up call almost.
And it can also be detrimental to your mental health. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a lot of studies out there and about putting people, especially very young people, in ADSEG, administrative segregation, isolation, whatever you want to call it. And it's becoming less and less common, but, you know, Couch could be in danger. I mean, he, as we said, he's notorious, but, you know, it could be taking a mental toll on him, just the segregation from the population and not getting to talk to people.
Yeah, and it's possible. I mean, the sheriff has said they may reevaluate his housing once they determine what his long-term jail stay might look like.
Mexican authorities arrested Dallas murder suspect Brenda Delgado after the FBI put her on its most wanted list, and Dallas County DA Susan Hawk took the death penalty off the table. Julie, can you tell us a little bit about what the police suspect Delgado did? Why is she charged with murder?
So police believe that Brenda Delgado is the mastermind behind the murder of Dr. Kendra Hatcher, who was shot to death in her uptown apartment parking garage last September. Police believe that Delgado kind of hatched this plan. Her indictment says that she and the cartel had given drugs to this guy to shoot Hatcher, and another woman was the driver. But police believe that she hatched this plan because it was a kind of a classic love triangle. She was jealous that her ex-boyfriend was dating Kendra Hatcher, and apparently was so livid when she found out that her ex-boyfriend had taken Hatcher back to meet his family that police say she concocted this plan.
So how did they catch her? Because she had been in Mexico for a while. They were looking for her. And I mentioned that Susan Hawk had to take the death penalty off the table because Mexico is staunchly anti-death penalty. And they basically won't help until the United States says, look, we're not going to try to kill this person for the crime they committed if they're convicted.
Right. Well, so Brenda Delgado actually had been interviewed by Dallas police last fall, kind of right in the weeks after Kendra Hatcher's murder. And then in early October, when the alleged shooter in the case, Christopher Love, was arrested, police also announced that they had a warrant for Brenda Delgado, but that she could not be located. So she's actually been on the run since at least early October of last year. You know, it's been 6 months, and, you know, she was put on the most wanted list, and then Susan Hawk came forward saying they would take the death penalty off the table, and then Friday, she's been captured.
Amazing!
Look at how that happened. Sarah Mervosh, who did a lot of the reporting, spoke to Delgado's attorney here in Dallas, and he said that they had actually been working on, I guess, a transfer where, you know, she would be brought to the border and handed over into, you know, United States custody. But I guess before that could happen, Mexican officials located her at a home where she was staying with her friend and took her into custody. So she's now in a Mexico City prison. And I guess earlier this week, the United States had formally requested for her to be extradited. So that's kind of the next step in this process.
And she's fighting extradition, and it's likely she's going to end up in Dallas, but it's going to be a process. Do you know how long we're looking at, and, you know, what's all involved, and how does it work?
Well, so the extradition process, I think, can take anywhere from, you know, 2 months to longer than 6 months. I mean, it really just kind of depends on, you know, if the person decides to cooperate or not. I don't think, I mean, the likelihood of her not ending up back in Dallas is very slim. It's very, I mean, I don't want to say impossible, but uncommon for Mexico to not extradite someone back for some, you know, a charge of murder. But I think taking the death penalty off the table certainly will help that. But I think it could take anywhere, you know, upwards of 6 months if she's fighting the process. I mean, Ethan Couch was extradited from Mexico, and that took a couple months. And he, you know, waived his, you know, he waived that. That kind of sped the process up a little bit. But we're probably looking at least 6 months, if not more, for her to get back here. So could be a lengthy process. I think people think it's quicker than it actually is.
My name is Maria Escamilla, and I am a survivor of a brutal attack of domestic violence. 5 years ago, I was brutally attacked by my ex-boyfriend. He beat me up, stabbed me, raped me, sodomized me, and left me for dead. It was never about the money. It was never about that. But we had to put a dollar amount to the amount of damage that he's done to me. And in doing so, it holds them liable, not just with time in prison, but above and beyond that, he continues to owe for what he's done. He hasn't finished paying with just 28 years. Once he's done with his sentence, he's not done paying. He still owes, because I will never be whole again.
That was Maria Escamilla, who was awarded more than $40 million after she was brutally attacked by her ex-boyfriend in 2011. Jen, you talked to the victim. What happened to her?
Maria was surprised in her home by her ex-boyfriend, Jose Arriola, and he did things to her that you would never think that someone could do to another person. He stabbed her in the face. He stabbed her in the breasts. He stabbed her in the vagina. He stabbed her everywhere. As she told you just now, he raped her. He sodomized her. And she needed 500 stitches. Her blood pressure dropped so low, she quit bleeding. The paramedics thought she was dead because of the injuries, and then she moved.
So did the ex-boyfriend testify at his trial?
He testified at the criminal trial back in 2013. But at the civil trial this week, where he was brought from prison, he did not testify. And Maria Escamilla's attorney actually made a point to the jury of saying, look, he didn't say he was sorry back in the criminal trial. He appealed and he didn't say he's sorry. And he sat here in court this week and he didn't say he was sorry. And the attorney, you know, thinks the jury was angry. They were enraged that this guy did this and then didn't get up there and have any remorse. You know, and the jury awarded what may be one of the largest, if not the largest, verdicts to a domestic violence survivor, in $40 million.
So he's in prison now, and it seems like maybe she won't even see a dime of the more than $40 million that she was awarded. Then why have a civil trial at all? What's her reasoning behind having one?
It's about the message, and it's in part that Dallas County won't tolerate this kind of abuse. In part, it's about sending a message to abusers to stop. It's about sending a message to those being victimized to get out before this happens to you or something worse happens. And originally, she had sued some of Ariola's family members too, and they did have assets, so she could have gotten money, but the judge tossed them out of the lawsuit because they had nothing to do with it. But she's never going to get anything. Her medical bills have reached more than $1 million. She had to have plastic surgery because she had very extensive injuries.
Jen, I know you kind of talked about the message, but how common is it for a person who suffered the, you know, this type of sexual abuse and physical abuse to be public about what happened to them? I can't imagine that must send a message to people that, you know, she wants her story told, and especially what's happened to her, to have those pictures of her now out on our website with your story.
It's happened before, but it's very rare. We've had rape victims in the Dallas Morning News who come forward with their name and their photograph. But I don't remember anyone who suffered not only rape, but the injuries that she did coming forward and saying, not only tell my story, but put my name on it, and here's my photo, and I'll talk on video about what happened to me. Until this happened, the jury's verdict yesterday, when we'd written about her case, we never identified her. At the Morning News, we don't identify victims of sex crimes unless they want to be, in part for their protection and their privacy.
So, Jen, how is Maria doing now? I mean, she had 500 stitches at one point, and now she's gone through two trials. What's her life like now?
As she said, I'm stronger than I was. She has more surgeries coming up. The damage from the knife left bones protruding into places where they shouldn't protrude, and so she needed surgeries to correct that. Her vision and her one of her eyes is always going to be a little blurry. She'll never have full use of one of her hands. She gets respiratory infections, in part from a collapsed lung and just all the damage. And the extensive stab wounds to her face means she's very susceptible to sinus infections, which, you know, if you've ever had one, and you probably have, they're really painful and can lead, if you know, not taken care of immediately, to those respiratory infections and bronchitis and maybe pneumonia. So she has to be really careful. She can't work, but she's speaking out on behalf of survivors like her. She's trying to get people to leave their abusers. She has made a documentary for Australia. She has gone to Mexico. So she's really putting herself out there to try to help other people. That's all for us today. Thanks for listening. You'll hear the latest Hashing It Out in just a moment. Stay tuned to DallasNews.com for more coverage of criminal justice issues. Remember to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. We are at Texas Crimecast. Thanks to our sound engineer, Tommy Noel, for Naheed Rajwani and Julie Fancher, I'm Jen Emily. We hope you stay safe out there. Now, we drop the mic.
Ethan Couch didn't ask to be born to parents who would prove wholly incapable of, you know, basic parenting. He didn't ask to become a public punching bag because a psychologist paid to testify used the word affluenza to describe that situation. Today it doesn't matter. Never truly held account for killing four people while driving Daddy's pickup truck very drunk and very high 3 years ago, Ethan's joy ride is over. Now he's 19, just another adult in the adult criminal system. Instead of a soft-headed juvenile court judge who blessed him with probation and rehab, Ethan must contend with just a small slice of the justice he deserves. District Judge Wayne Salvant sentenced him to 180 days in jail for each death. That would be 2 years if the judge doesn't back down upon further review. 2 years for four lives ended by stupidity, not to mention a dozen other injuries in his wake. Young Ethan has played a supporting cast member in a beer pong video and fugitive on the run with his mom to Mexico. Beyond the jail time, he will be on probation until February 2024. He has wasted every second chance he ever received, and they are many. The odds he can stay straight for that long? Barely a rhetorical question.